Hello, I'm Father Mitch Pacwa, and welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. And our guest tonight wins the Long Distance Award, traveling to be with us all the way from the Philippines, where he is an attorney specializing in international economic law and constitutional law. Of course, the Constitution of the Philippines. He is also the Dean of the Institute of Law at the University of Asia and the Pacific in Pasig City, just outside of Manila. He's here tonight to share with us how we can defend and share the good that is freedom of religion, the Catholic deposit of faith, and how those things can sustain marriages, families, and the broader society. He's also written a fine book called Natural Law and the Limits of Judicial Power. So please welcome Dr. Jemai Gadula. Doctor, welcome. Good to have you here with us. Yeah. Appreciate you coming all this way. Yeah. I know that you had other business here, but it was delightful that you would stop at EWTN as well. So we appreciate your presence. You know, one of the questions I have, has natural law studies and investigation always been part of your training as a lawyer?
Well, no, actually. I started out really as an international lawyer, public international lawyer. Mm-hmm. That was my studies when I went to Cambridge, mm-hmm. and for the better part of my career.
And that's Cambridge?
In England.
England.
Yes.
We have one here, too.
I heard, yeah.
Yeah. Harvard.
Yeah. One of the younger universities,
yes.
I think.
So, yes, indeed. That university is old.
Yeah. So a better part of my career was actually in international trade. I was working on WTO issues, ASEAN issues. And somehow along the way, I found myself working on natural law. And for some reason, it was actually quite good timing because it was on the cusp of my country undergoing several really serious debates, particularly involving sexual issues. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it came on in handy at the proper time.
So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this, first of all, one of the things we should do is talk about what is natural law? What do you mean by this as a principle?
Well, technically it's an objective standard of right and wrong that you can arrive at, that any human being can arrive at with the use of reason. Mm-hmm. Another way of putting it is that it's an intellectual tradition, starting all the way from the Greeks, and which allows us to be able to know what is good or bad, mm-hmm. what is the series of human goods that we need to achieve, and again, without necessarily relying on scripture, but we can discern from the use of our intellect.
That's yeah, so it's not something that when you read in the Bible, thou shalt follow the natural law. That's not in there, is it?
No. But a lot of the things in the Bible, particularly in the Ten Commandments, would actually be embodiments of the natural law as well.
Exactly, so. Exactly. And we'll get to that in a bit. And in a way, it's the Greeks reflect on what natural law might mean, especially Plato and Aristotle. But you also see that the principles that are used in natural law appear in the Code of Hammurabi,
yes,
in Babylon, and also in the Sumerian law codes. Mm. The Egyptians never had anything like that, but the Sumerians and the Babylonians did have such a law. And it actually, the Hammurabi's code spread all over the ancient Near East. So, mm-hmm. you know, these things were spread around quite a bit. Yeah. But the Greeks really did make that into, and by the way, just so our audience understands, Hammurabi lived a good 1400 years or so before, you know, Aristotle and Plato. Mm-hmm. So which points to what you're saying. Mm. It's something humans can
something universal,
think
yes.
and reason to, mm-hmm. rather than depend on God's revelation. It's already in us.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, yes, it's true. one of the things I think that the reason why the Greeks had some sort of advantage with being identified with natural law is because of the other achievements that they had. Mm-hmm. And obviously Aristotle surviving and later on being adopted by Aquinas also led to a huge part of our understanding of natural law from the Greek perspective or yes. from the Roman perspective.
So. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And this has affected our law. I mean, first of all, what kind of law system is used in the Philippines?
Well, actually, a lot of it is Western in tradition. Mm-hmm. We're an interesting combination of Spanish and American law. And in law school, we used to be taught that we are a combination of a common law and civil law system. Mm-hmm. I think pretty much you were mentioning earlier that we're talking about constitutional law from the Philippine perspective or Philippine constitutional law. Mm-hmm. But our constitutional system is quite similar to what the U.S. Constitution is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why many of us, myself included, find it incredibly necessary to be studying constitutional law from the U.S. perspective, because it also gives us a hint or ideas on how to interpret our own constitution.
Do you have a Bill of Rights similar to the American Bill of Rights?
Yes, very much. Mm-hmm. A little bit expanded, but to answer your question, yes. And the wordings itself are quite similar to okay. what the U.S. Bill of Rights are.
So. Okay. So this is very significant because your courts, especially your Supreme Court, would then depend on your constitution for making law, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And that's supposed to be what ours does as well. And for us, the Declaration of Independence is really something of a preamble before the Constitution. The Constitution, our Declaration of Independence is the establishment of the nation, mm-hmm. and this is the working out of the law code.
Yes, plus the Articles of Confederation, I believe.
Yes.
And also, some people would say probably the Gettysburg Address would form the core constitutional yeah. documents of the U.S. Yes. For the Philippines, I think our constitutional document, the core one, would be the 1987 Constitution, the present version that we have now. The link that we have to the U.S. Constitution is quite strong. And so, for example, when we interpret the words that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law, that's exactly the way the Bill of Rights enumerated or worded those particular rights. With respect, for example, in the word due process, mm-hmm. we keep a mind or an eye on how the U.S. courts would interpret it. And I'm not necessarily saying we're copying it, but it does give us an inspiration. Mm-hmm. Probably because of the fact that you had more time to deliberate on the matter and so on.
Sure, so, sure. And a couple things that I think would be worth it for us to discuss. When we say that natural law is based on reason, it's mm-hmm. not something that is derived from divine revelation, but it's not in contradiction mm-hmm. of revelation either. Mm-hmm. But it's something based on reason. What would be the way that people begin to make moral decisions based on natural law? How do we use it in the way we think about right and wrong?
Well, a lot of it would start with a proper understanding of what human nature is and what human dignity is. Mm-hmm. There's a comment that, let's say we do not agree that there is a unity in body and intellect with people, would there still be a natural law? And the answer there is yes, but the consequences, the effects of that would be quite utterly different from the natural law that we understand now. Mm-hmm. So the only way, for example, for natural law to be able to provide us the proper understanding of what our moral system is, all of it would start first with the proper understanding of what human nature is, which is a unity of the body and intellect, which is essentially what the Catholic Church teaches, not the duality, mm-hmm. not the Gnosticism that other philosophical systems.
And by Gnosticism, what do you mean?
To put it in a nutshell, it would be the fact that our body is essentially just a casing for our intellect. Mm-hmm. There is a philosopher, I think Gilbert Ryle, who coined the term, which later on became famous for with anime fans, the Ghost in the Shell. And so so that's essentially what they view as human nature is.
And,
so,
and you know. There was even another philosopher who talked about the ghost in the machine.
Yeah, well, it's the same.
Same idea.
The same, yes.
That was a book well known in the 1960s here. Yeah. So it's that's not what we would be human nature. It's not just a machine with a ghost in it.
And you can see the implications on societies that employ that kind of belief, and in the way that they find it easy, for example, to impose laws on euthanasia, for example, mm-hmm. For encephalitic babies, the babies that were born without a brain. Their ability to look at that person, that human being, and then view them as not actually human beings, makes it easier for them to impose measures that we find abhorrent or not likable. As far as we are concerned, and you could see this in our constitutional system, our criminal law system, the way we view marriage, the way we impose contracts, for example, we look at a human being as both a body and intellect. Obviously, if you're Catholic, a body and a soul, but let's say we do not employ religious language, it will be most a body and an intellect. And therefore, every action, every choice that we make has to be in consideration of that body and intellect unity.
Okay. And that this really gets to different worldviews mm-hmm. that are not only in other law systems, but that's a tension in the United States and I think in Western Europe, as there is, in many ways, a rejection of the unity of a mind, or we oftentimes would say the soul and the body, that unity is, you know, denied, and these more closer to Gnostic ideas that the body is just a shell, the mind is there, and you can get rid of the shell or the body. It's not that important if the mind isn't what we expect it to be.
And you can see it also with regard to how they view marriage. Mm-hmm. For them, marriage is essentially a unity of the mind, not necessarily the complementarity of the body. Mm-hmm. And that's where the argument for same-sex marriage actually arises from. Mm-hmm. For us, our view of marriage is the complete unity of the body and the intellect, in that there has to be both a romantic attachment and at the same time the complementarity of the sexual union between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. And so that's the sad thing about it. I remember a time before when political differences would essentially rest on mere differences in policy, whether taxes are higher or you have lower taxes and so on. But now we've come to a point wherein people are actually fighting on what actual reality is. Mm-hmm. And that really poses a huge amount of difficulty when you're conducting a national discourse, when people can't even agree on what is real and what is true.
Well, this shows up in the present day discussion that comes about transgender people, that if your inner mind feels like the opposite sex, then you can change your body to adapt in little ways. I mean, the sex changes really are, you know, relatively external. I mean, they have big effects on the body. And even if the sex change will reduce your life expectancy by 50%, which it does.
Yes.
That's okay, so long as my mind fits some of my body parts' self-image, because the body parts are just silly putty. You can just change it any way you want.
Yes. And that's take aside the fact that interfering with our body parts is essentially an act of ingratitude towards God that provided us that body.
Yeah, that would be where revelation comes in. But in terms of reason,
well. So you have a situation where everybody begins to say certain things, which obviously, with regard to our senses, our eyes would be quite different from what we see. And so it becomes, because of the fact that you do not have that single standard, that unifying framework for people to work in, what is reality becomes therefore a numbers game. The more that you can persuade people to follow what your reality is, then that is the reality that we impose. For us, reality is reality. But for them, reality is essentially how many people that they could have on their side. So in essence, it becomes a might makes right situation, which is not really the best way moving forward.
Not the best way. I would say it's really a horrid way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I knew two of my relatives that survived concentration camps that were imposed on Europe by someone who held a might makes right morality. I mean, yeah. Hitler, you know, imposed, mm-hmm. you know, might makes right. I won, I defeated Poland, mm-hmm. so I get to do with the people what I want.
Yes, interestingly enough, so this interview has been conducted on the feast of Maximilian Kolbe.
Yes.
And of course we know his, the martyrdom that he did, the courage that he exhibited during the concentration camp days in Nazi Germany. But what actually occurred to me just now is that you had one person exhibiting that courage. I mean, this is not to downplay the courage exhibited by countless people that mm-hmm. we don't know of and stuff. Mm-hmm. But in essence, courage is an incredibly rare thing. It was rare then, apparently, and it's becoming rare now. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's one of the main reasons why we're in this difficult situation where people are exhibiting incredibly insane things, and not many people are finding the nerve to be able to speak up against it.
Well, one of the things that goes on, for instance, with gender reassignment surgery mm-hmm. and such, there is a huge amount of money involved in that. The surgeries themselves are very, very lucrative. One professor at Vanderbilt University Hospital said these gender reassignments are financing our whole department. Mm-hmm. He came out and admitted that this was lucrative, and he was all in it. Secondly, people like Planned Parenthood are the main distributors of the hormones. And that's financed by the federal government, so they get huge amounts of federal support for that. Mm-hmm. But then the ideologues will come down on anybody who has any objections. Medical doctors who point out the research in Europe showing that it reduces life expectancy by 50%. Those doctors can't publish in the scientific journals with scientific results. Mm-hmm. They're not allowed. They're not allowed. That they this might is financial, and it's also editorial. Mm-hmm. And in society, they will do everything they can to silence you.
Yes, I think what happened. What we're having right now is a strange marriage between the left and capitalist or multinational corporations. Mm-hmm. And I think it started basically with Occupy Wall Street, which essentially freaked out a lot of the
When you talk about Occupy Wall Street, what are you referring to there?
That movement a couple of years ago, wherein they started making encampments around Central Park mm-hmm. and so on, which I believe in a way caused great concern among multinational corporations, the banks, the financial system. And so they entered into this kind of seemingly arrangement wherein the left would not bother them or spare them mm-hmm. Any attacks. And the multinational corporations decided to adopt a lot of the positions that the left has taken. So, I mean, all this time, it's always been the left against capitalism, mm-hmm. the left against the big corporations. But as you just narrated right now, you have all these big pharma, all these big multinational media corporations essentially aligning themselves with the left. This has not happened in at any point before in history. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also one of the reasons why we're such in a big problem, because of the fact that you have this incredibly misguided ideology, but at the same time, human greed is supporting that ideology.
And so. I recently read a book by a financial reporter. You know, he does financial news reporting, named Gasparino. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book called Go Woke, Go Broke. Mm-hmm. And in there, he says that it's that part of the reason for the alignment is that the universities are feeding their students into the big corporation. They teach them to promote this mentality that, you know, at core, your mind is a ghost inside this body of yours. And from that comes changes in, total changes in morality. Your body is just silly putty. And that teach them all these far left ideologies. So when they go work in the corporations with that ideology, they are already there. They're already woke, as he says. And the big corporations are now just sort of going along with this process because this is who they hire, as well as they think it'll make them money. Then, as Gasparino points out in his book, Go Woke, Go Broke, you hear in the title, the corporations who do that lose a lot of money. That it's not a good business model. So it's not successful for many, but for some it is.
But 2 points there. In the Philippines, I think with regard to the universities, except for the government universities, the huge part of our income is coming from the tuition, which I think is not the same as far as American universities are, wherein a lot of their revenue, the ability to keep them afloat, is essentially coming from grants. And these grants are essentially funded by the corporations themselves.
Yes.
So they're incredibly dependent on research grants and, and all of that. So it becomes a self-sustaining system when you look at it. And the other point I wanted to make is that it's incredibly weird that they would rather go down than admit that they're wrong. So you have companies, for example, like Amazon, Netflix, Disney. The Paris Olympics just lost an incredible amount of money, and yet they would still insist in creating a product that they know is not going to work for God knows what reason that they do that.
Budweiser beer was another example.
Yes, the Bud Light thing. In the Philippines, in my university, we had a research done with regard to a mall that had movie cinemas in it. And one of the things that they found out is that if you showed movies that with a lot of sexual content, the revenue for the movies went down. Whereas if you showed a lot of family-friendly movies, then the revenue went up. Now, that big mall, SM, is decided to change their policy in showing movies, and they focus more on family-friendly movies. We, of course, remember Chariots of Fire and all those other movies.
Yes,
that
wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Which really earned
Gandhi,
money.
Beautiful movie and
they
uplifting.
Earned. Yeah, and quite importantly also for the other aspect is that they really earned for their producers. And now you have people like, for example, Disney coming up with woke, so-called woke movies, and they're incredibly not earning money.
No, they're losing money.
Exactly so.
But that gets to this natural law reality. If natural law is built into us, if it is natural to us, then it makes sense that most people still have enough reason and sense to recognize that this other model, based on an understanding of humans as just a ghost in a machine, that model is fake. That people are, you know, there are a lot of people who are obviously jumping into it, but also some people say, wait a minute, this isn't the way that we're supposed to be. And there's some reaction, but the advantage of learning how to think with natural law is that you begin to figure out why I don't really like this, why this isn't quite right. And that's what we have to learn to think about, why it's wrong to follow that, you know, foolish and false wokeness.
Yeah, but the crucial words that you use there is also learn to think, which requires effort. And the environment right now essentially does not really demand a lot of effort from people. First of all, I mean, it's mean, it's not really inaccurate to say it's written in us, but still, for us to be able to know natural law, particularly with regard to the more difficult issues on euthanasia, on cloning, for example, mm-hmm. that requires an amount of time, of effort, and study, and it doesn't really just come automatically. People would like to hide behind the saying that we, you know, follow your conscience and all of that, but conscience has to be properly formed. It needs to be trained. It needs to come to a proper understanding. Otherwise, you're just going to be led astray. I mean, if you take, for example, a drug dealer, one cannot say that drug dealer's conscience would be similar to a person who has an upstanding life and so on. So obviously, there's a need to train. But I think in today's society, as we were discussing earlier before the show, when you have an environment that is too tired to read and they're quite content with the number of tweets that they come out in the characters, when you have Uber Eats available for 24/7 delivery, when you have shows that you can call on demand and so on, the ability for people to muster the necessary restraint, temperance, discipline is highly weakened. And all of those characteristics is what you need for study. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, if you're not exhibiting that restraint, that temperance, you let your emotions come through. And a lot of the things that we're seeing right now is essentially, there was a father, I think Loniker, who mentioned the dictatorship of sentimentality is what's going, is what's actually reigning right now for us.
Well, this is where, on one hand, a lot of people confuse their conscience with their emotions.
Yes.
And they're not the same at all. You know, conscience is a function of reason. You have to think with your conscience. Mm-hmm. And in traditionally, the and you see this in Confucius and Lao Tzu, mm-hmm. as well as in the Bible, in teachings of Christ, and in law codes around the world where there's civilization, that you, what they call at least the silver rule, mm-hmm. don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. Mm-hmm. That's the most basic underlying principle of natural law, correct?
Yes, the other basic principles would be is you do good, avoid evil.
Yes.
And the fact that you do not use a bad thing, you do not employ a bad thing to achieve a good end. Essentially, the Pauline principle that the ends do not justify the means.
Yes.
And so, one has to really train for this and discipline one's mind for this. I'd like to think of natural law as something that's the natural law and conscience as the difference between strategy and tactics. Obviously, a lot of analogies are flawed, but that's what we're going on for right now. So natural law will tell you essentially how to get to be a fully functioning human being, the so-called human flourishing that the Greeks would tell us. Now, what is conscience? Conscience is the one that tells us what to do on a particular daily basis on the vast gamut of human interactions that we go through. So natural law tells us that we should be working hard, we should not be lazy, we should go to work and we should study. Essentially, that would contribute to our human flourishing. Let's say, however, on a particular Thursday, there's a need for you to stay at home because it's better for you to just be with your family, so you call off work. Would that be a violation of natural law? Not necessarily. Because on that particular day, your conscience is telling you that it's better for you to stay with your family. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the decision would be different if you're a person who's predisposed to becoming lazy or allowed himself to be self-indulgently lazy. For you to make a decision, I will not work on this day, I will just stay with my family, will not be the same as a hardworking person who decides on this particular day, I will stay with my family. Mm-hmm. So to be able to know the difference requires a lot of discernment, a lot of study, and that's something I think that's lacking right now. Despite mm-hmm. the fact that a lot of people are going to universities, despite the fact that we have a huge amount of information going available online, people are just not really taking the time to be able to exhibit the necessary discipline to go through that training.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that went on when I was growing up is that we learned about right and wrong in a number of places. A, my father and mother together taught us right and wrong, and they backed each other up. At school, they gave us the same basic ways of thinking about right. And they taught us through the different levels how to think about right and wrong. How do you confront different kinds of situations? This was part of the education. And I don't know about the Philippines, but in the United States, our Supreme Court, I think, infringed on our rights, and now it's been changed, but they made it, they decreed back in 81 or 82 that you could not display the Ten Commandments in public schools or other public places. It was forbidden to do so. Mm-hmm. And one of our Alabama Supreme Court justices tried to do it, and he got, you know, big trouble for that. Mm-hmm. But this, if you can't do that, then you don't have a basis for teaching natural law in the public schools. That they're basically not allowed to do that, even though it's natural law isn't based on Ten Commandments, it's reason. Mm-hmm. But you can't teach that legally. Mm-hmm. You surreptitiously, many teachers do, mm-hmm. but a lot of times you can't.
Well, we talked about the improper relationship that corporations have with the universities. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you mentioned something that, with regard to your growing up, and that is the fact that your ability to learn good from bad essentially came from your parents. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, one of the great tragedies of today. 52%, I think, of children right now that will be born in the United States will be from unwed parents.
That's right. Went up to 52% back around 2016. Mm-hmm.
And in the Philippines, it's actually 58%. Of newborn children that will be to unwed parents. Yeah. And so, I mean, despite the fact that you have the whatever great university that you have there, the best still educational system that the child could have would always be having the biological father and mother in the home living together.
Yes.
Because a lot of the learning will essentially be them watching, not necessarily getting verbal instruction from the parents, but them watching the parents, how they interact with each other, how they behave. And if that is not present, if the father, for example, is not in the home, then...
Which is usually the case.
Which is now becoming the usual, yes. Which is not good. And so it becomes very difficult, therefore, for the child to be able to really learn deeply and profoundly what is right and wrong.
Yeah. So. We have to take a little break, but we're going to come back in a couple minutes and continue this discussion, because this brings up a whole other aspect of what's going on in the breakdown of using natural law. So please stay with us. Just been speaking about how important it is to learn how to think and how to use reason. And Dr. Jamai Gatdullah has this book called Natural Law and the Limits of Judicial Power. Is available at EWTNRC.com, our religious catalog, EWTNRC.com. And if you go there, it is item 6529. And that would be a good way to start picking this up and learning more about this and teaching, you know, people to think in this natural law way. And this, we're starting to say how part of natural law and the way that human beings exist in reality is that we are a body-soul union. That's our personhood, mm-hmm. to be body and soul. And that is the reason that a man and a woman can marry, because mm-hmm. it's not only that they think alike, but also their bodies are mutually complementary. You know, a man and a woman who have waited until marriage for intimacy and who stay faithful to each other can't get sexually transmitted diseases, can they?
No, they can't.
This is something that would be in a certain logical way a pointer towards fidelity towards one person, and marital fidelity and preparation for that by chastity ahead of time is not just something that the church wants to impose its laws on. It's our bodies are made for, just like our bodies are made for good food, not for potato chips and soda pop. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not what we were made to eat. We may like it, but it's not what's good for us. And we're made for a balanced diet of protein, carbs, vegetables, to get vitamins. This is the whole way that you prepare your body. That's why, you know, I was blessed. My mother was a wonderful cook, but she cooked balanced meals for us. You know, and so because the food goes with who you are, but you make it tasty because that body and soul combination associates food not only with nourishment, but with, you know, certain smells still remind me of home, you know, and that's the way it is. This is part of the natural role of family in general. Family is not just imposed. You hear people crazily, and it's a madness. Well, the doctor imposes a gender on you at birth. I don't think so. That occurred the moment of conception.
Yes.
Not later. You're either XX or XY with a few variations. But family is no more imposed either. This is the natural way for people to live and learn how to think and reason through life.
Yes, that's true. Even before the baby is born, the relationship that the baby will form with the mother, the ability to recognize the voice, the voice of the mother, the fact that the mother and the baby would be essentially feeding off each other. And this is even
in that case with a mother, quite literally.
Yes, and the fact that the moment, for example, a baby is born, it releases a huge amount of, let's say, hormones, both in the father and the mother, and also with regard to the baby. There's this utterly profound relationship between the three individuals that are now there that constitutes the family, And this cannot be duplicated by the state, by the government, no matter how hard they try. In this particular case, you were mentioning the doctors. Mm-hmm. But even then, let's even assume that they have the best of intentions. One still cannot duplicate the care, the risks that will be have to be borne, the need to understand that particular individual that you're making a decision for. It's simply not there. Something that you mentioned earlier about with regard to natural law, with regard to marriage and the others, people sometimes say that there's no sanction or penalty in relation to natural law. And that's why people say that, okay, that's not a real law, because law normally would have a sanction. But natural law does have sanctions. And when you just mentioned one, if, for example, you have a spouses that are unfaithful to each other, the fact that there's a lack of trust already, making people miserable, the possibility of having STDs. These are not the normal sanctions that we think of as law, but these are sanctions nevertheless.
Because those are not sanctions imposed upon us by some human faculty, say like the police, mm-hmm. or the courts necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's something that happens by the way nature works.
And the other thing that people have to consider is that a lot of the things that we do are done not because of the fact that we follow law. I mean, the legal system can only do so much. So let's say, for example, I have my iPad here. The one thing that's stopping you, for example, from stealing this iPad is not because of the police. You could probably do it without even the police having any evidence whatsoever that you got my iPad. Mm-hmm. But what's stopping you from stealing my iPad is essentially your formation, your decision, your conscience itself. And so a lot of our human interactions rest not because of the law imposing itself, but because we believe, we know from our own intellect and our consciences what right and wrong is. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes us go as a society moving forward. If, for example, somebody does steal somebody's slippers from one's house and the law is not able to catch that, first of all, it's a slipper. Why would the police bother with somebody stealing somebody's slippers and so on? Okay, fine, so nobody got to prison because of that. But eventually, what you will see is the neighborhood will suddenly start locking their doors, the windows will now be barred, and there's now a mistrust among the people in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so that is your sanction, in essence, of what you have with regard to natural law.
When I grew up inside the city of Chicago, not in the suburb or something, but in the city of Chicago itself, we never locked our doors. Mom would frequently leave the keys in the car, and there was not a problem. It was, and kids would come in and out, and that was just the way it was. You can't do that anymore. We even identify children as latchkey, that they have a key around their neck so they can let themselves in, because you can't leave your house open.
Yeah, and that's the one thing actually I'm sad about the children nowadays. I remember when I was growing up, I would wake up in the morning, have breakfast, and then probably go out with my friends starting now 9 a.m. This is during the summer break when we have no classes. And we'll probably be back probably 5 p.m. before dinner.
Yeah.
And nobody worried.
No. I mean, as as a 10-year-old, my buddy and I, my brother, took the bus and the subway by ourselves, and went about 15 miles through the city of Chicago to go see the White Sox play baseball. Mm-hmm. You know, it was 75 cents to get in those days. Mm-hmm. It was affordable. But we could do that. And, our parents were a little nervous we might get lost, but we knew our way around the city, and, that was the way it was. Mm-hmm. And, this was something that we could do the same. We did exactly that same kind of growing up. We'd go out the door, come in to eat something, but we were outside all day on our bikes. Mom didn't carry us around. And there was a basic trust, that you could ride the streets of Chicago and on your bicycle, and you were pretty safe. Yeah. Not anymore. Because you don't have the natural law respect for property. Somebody might steal your bicycle, possibly steal your shoes, mm-hmm. if they're, certain popular brands, and kill you in the process, as we see in the cities.
Mm-hmm. One other aspect of the natural law is because of the fact that if you do not do the human inclinations, the reasonable human inclinations, for example, to work, to be able to fend off for yourself, to be able to feed yourself and your family. What happens then is that because of the fact that you have that lack of responsibility, which is required of you as a human being, you become more dependent on the state. And the thing is that the state does not generate income. Whatever happens, no government on earth, I believe, actually generates income.
No.
What they do is they get income from other people.
Who
does generate the income.
Yeah.
And so what essence is that they would get the taxes from people, and then they would try to give it to other people who do not necessarily act responsibly on the on that funding.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, what the effect is that there's a huge amount of loss of freedom, because now you could have chosen to do certain things with your money, and moved anywhere. You could have toured somewhere. You could have bought this particular product. You could have enrolled your child in this particular school. That freedom now becomes lessened because of the fact that the government is taking that money and now making decisions for you for that money that you earned. So there's this, again, component of your loss of your ability to become a fully human, fully flourishing human being, simply because of the fact that you acted against your inclinations.
There's something that we saw, I think it was just over a year ago, that Mr. Klaus Schwab, he's, I believe, Swiss himself, and he organizes this meeting for big government leaders and big corporation leaders. And for years, they have been pushing, you know, what they call the woke, but it's really the anti-natural law agenda that would, and last, just over a year ago, he had said at Davos, Switzerland meeting, because he's sort of the pope of that. He's the religious leader of that.
And he dresses the part, actually.
He does, I know. And he said to the world, you, that is everybody in the world, you will own nothing and you will be happy. And I said, you know, if we own nothing, we will be prisoners of the ones who do own everything, whether it's the big corporations, quite likely, or the state. You know, I've lived in and worked in very poor parishes in this country, and back in Chicago and elsewhere. And you see, the public housing is not beautiful. They don't make beautiful housing. The government isn't capable. They are capable of what they call efficiency, which means cheap. And then, you know, I'll never forget when they had worried about so many people being in these big buildings, 16 stories, one block, 5,000 children on a block, mm-hmm. with no place to play. They put fencing up along the outside so that people wouldn't be thrown over. They literally fenced people inside their house. Mm-hmm. The Chinese do
this. Yes, I was about to say. Yeah.
Yep. They have locks on the outside, mm-hmm. of the door.
And you had literally people being burned to death during the pandemic because of the fact that they had to lock down people. And one building, unfortunately, started went on fire.
Yes.
And you had people.
Nobody could let them out?
Yes.
They had nobody had the keys for the outside, mm-hmm. lock. This is truly where if you lose your right to property, which is part of natural law, to own your own property and make decisions with what you've earned, mm-hmm. you become a slave of the person who does own it. And slavery is against natural law.
And not only that, you lose your humanity. Yeah. One of the things that natural law requires of us is, I have to say truthful things to you. Because if I don't, then the natural consequence of that would be is that you won't trust me,
yep.
and therefore we won't have a proper relationship. And if everybody does that in society, society breaks down. So that is just one example. There are a huge other range of virtues that are required of us as human beings. Temperance, honesty.
Courage.
You need to work hard and so on.
The cardinal virtues.
Yes. Now, if, for example, we decide to forego our freedoms and allow ourselves to be enslaved with regard to, let's say, be dependent on the government or whatever it is.
Or the large corporations.
Large corporations. What we do is we reduce ourselves to not being in need of exercising the virtues. Because there's no need for me, for example, to express honesty with regard to you, because I get nothing from you anyway. I get my benefits from the government, not from our interaction. I don't need to work hard. I don't need to produce anything. I don't need to produce a product that I will sell to you, for example, because in order for me to sell you a product, you have to trust me. You have to trust that the product I'm selling you is actually quite good. You have to trust. I also have to trust you that when I sell you the product, you will give me money in exchange for that. So this entire system is based on virtues of trust, loyalty, courage, as you said, and
prudence,
the ability, prudence,
temperance.
And ability to work hard. Mm-hmm. But if you have the government and we decide to allow the government to just take care of us, there's no need for me to be honest with you. There's no need for me to be working hard anymore. And by doing so, it may come off as being beneficial, but in the end, what's happening is that I'm just reducing myself to being a cog of the state and not being human anymore.
And at that point, you know, that I'm a cog of the state and I'm dependent on the state. You know, you see the breakdown of family. The breakdown of family in the African-American community in the United States began in the 1950s when the government started giving aid to dependent children benefits, that children where the father had left, abandoned a wife and children, they got help from the government. That's the aid to dependent children starting in the 50s. And from that point on, the idea of a man being and a woman being responsible to each other and to their children broke down. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that this has affected the African-American community to the point where they have 78% of their children born to unmarried people, and that the government doesn't allow them to flourish and become wealthy. They prevent that. Mm-hmm. And instead, they get by on what they need, but it's not going to be something that most people can flourish on. And without a mom and a dad to train them, mm-hmm, in natural law and reason, mm-hmm, and do so together with the complementarity of man and woman, it becomes very difficult to flourish.
Yeah, the thing is that sometimes people are very stubborn and they refuse to learn. I mean, okay, you mentioned something in the 1950s. In 1931, there was a pope, I think Pope Pius XI.
Yes. Yes,
and he decided to make an encyclical called Quadragesimo Anno.
Yes.
And why did he do that? Well, he looked around and he saw Italy and Germany running the trains well. People are fully employed. There's peace and order. No criminality. And so one would wonder, why would you worry about that enough to make an encyclical about the subsidiarity? Mm-hmm. And what he realized is that people are very much willing to surrender their freedoms. Willing to surrender their freedoms, the willingness to think for themselves, all for short-term advantages that the Nazi Germany at that time, and also with regard to the totalitarian Italy or fascist Italy was providing them. In the end, Pope Pius was saying, you know, people have to learn that in order to be human, they have to take responsibility for their lives. They cannot allow themselves to be essentially just elements of the government for the government to be taken care of. And it's a lesson that we have to continually teach our people and have to keep on learning.
Yeah, those Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, as well as communist Russia and China, the governments try to have total control of the economy, and they enslave their people.
Yeah, because
I'm afraid that we're running out of time, unfortunately. I just want to make sure that I tell folks, to learn more and think more about these issues, I recommend you get a hold of Dr. Jemai Gotdullah's book, Natural Law and the Limits of Judicial Power, item 6529, available at EWTNRC. I wish we had another hour, but we have to get going. And I have a small relic of St. Maximilian Kolbe, who died in a slave labor death camp for our faith and for charity to another human. I'll bless you with this. By his intercession, may the Lord bless you all and keep you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. And we can do these programs and bring you all the other shows that we have here at EWTN only because the network is brought to you by you. Pray that the Lord would inspire you to keep remembering us in between your gas bill, your electric bill, and your cable bill, and we'll pay our bills too. God bless you all, and thank you.